Hi, everyone. I'm so happy that you could join me tonight after a beautiful Shabbat here at Chabad NDG. I'm going to talk about my sermon, the sermon I gave today, obviously not with the same enthusiasm as I'm able to give it at the podium on Shabbat. But at least for those of you who weren't there, you'll be able to get a little bit of a summary and idea of what I spoke about today. Especially, I want to give a shout out to Michael Kraus. Michael Kraus, who is recovering from a surgery, and you couldn't be with us today, our chazen, our regular chazen, and we missed you a lot. And Victoria Zuckerman, who is celebrating her sixth birthday, my good friend. And I know, Victoria, you miss my sermon when you can't hear it. I know that. So I did this for you. Today I dedicated my sermon to two incredible young men, Samuel and Diego Sheesh. These two young men are going to be celebrating their bar mitzvah in exactly a month from today, on Purim morning. And why I dedicated to them is because teaching them for their bar mitzvah has been a beautiful, beautiful experience. It's always an amazing experience to teach B'nai Mitzvah, to teach young future leaders of our community. But for them, I've watched them grow. I met them when they were 10 months old the first time. I knocked on their door on Hanukkah. They just moved into the neighborhood. And I have been had the great privilege of watching these two young men grow into really young men, incredible young men, inquisitive, good ideas. And when their parents first asked me to teach them for the bar mitzvah, they really thought about what would be the important elements of bar mitzvah. Now, often when a young man comes to bar mitzvah, the parents want the young man to learn the Torah reading. Now, I think it's a wonderful thing, yet the Torah reading is something that the young man will probably only use once or twice in his life. Where, what would a young Jewish man or woman today need in their life? And so their parents asked me, especially with what's going on in the world today, and so many young people who have no idea about Jewish history, they asked me to start from the beginning, from the Bible, and to go through the entire Jewish history with their children. And I can tell you, it's been an emotional roller coaster, even for me, to go through all of these stories with them. This past week, we finished the five books of Moses, and we're going to get into the prophets next week. But it was really emotional. I mean, we were kind of crying, thinking about Moses not making it to the promised land. You know, God takes him up to the mountain, and he could see it over the mountaintop, but he can't go in. It was very emotional. And we were talking about what that means in the world. And what's fascinating is this week's Torah portion was Tetzaveh. And Tetzaveh is the one portion in the entire Torah that Moses' name is not in it. The reason why Moses' name is not in it, I did an entire sermon on this for those of you who were following, is because Moses said to God, after the Jewish people sinned with the golden calf, that if God didn't forgive the people, that he should take Moses out of the Torah. Now, God forgave the people, but Moses still said that. And because Moses said that, something had to happen. The power of words. I think about this so often now. The power of words. The power that when you say something, today we say words so freely, almost cheaply. The power of words. When you say something, even if you don't mean it, something happens. For sure in the heavens, but even sometimes here on earth. So we have to be so careful about the power of our words. And so because Moses said that if you don't forgive the people, take me out of your Torah, there was one portion in the four books, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, where Moses, his name is in every single portion. And God said to Moses, there's one portion where Moses' name is not said. And that's this week's portion, because of his words, because of the power of words. Now, today also happens to be Purim Katan. We call it the mini Purim because we're in a leap year, and we've spoken about what that means, being in a leap year. There's an extra month. But if we were not in the leap year, today would have been the holiday of Purim. And so I think that it's a good day to start studying the messages of the festival. And I want to talk about a couple of events that happened that I believed reshaped the Jewish world. And it so happens to be that all of these events happened on Purim or Purim Katan. Today, in the year 1920, in the throes of the Russian Revolution, the evil Bolsheviks burst in on a Purim Farbrengen, a Purim celebration. At the helm of this celebration is the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Sholom Dov Ber Schneerson, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, let's understand and paint a picture of what's going on here. Russia is in a state of murderous anarchy, and the Bolsheviks were deeply feared. When they entered this celebration, many of the people who were there believed this was the end, God forbid. Because this celebration violated so many of the cardinal rules that were prevalent during that time. People were assembled. They weren't allowed to be assembled. They were drinking. They were collecting donations. And it was a Jewish celebration. It was the holiday of Purim. The Bolsheviks, they were deeply feared. The people were scared. That was it. When they walk in, it's it. The Rebbe stands up and he says in a loud voice, "I'm not impressed by them. Ignore them." And to their faces, he began lecturing on the history of anti-Semitism, how one by one, the enemies of the Jews have bitten the dust. And the Rebbe Rashab said that as long as we're able to sacrifice ourselves, they will never win, and Judaism will never die. It was an amazing moment. People spoke about being there in 1920 and seeing him in the face of persecution, in the face of terrible communism, anti-Semitism, being able to stand up to the perpetrator. The Rebbe's son and his eventual successor, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, he feared for his father's life. But his father turned to him and he said, "Yosef Yitzchak, do not look at them. They will disappear." And unbelievable, to the shock of everyone there, they did. They left. Nothing was ever spoken of this moment. No one could believe it. They were going against the government. The Bolsheviks, they were not easy people. They disappeared. 3 weeks later, the Rebbe Rashab took ill and passed away. His only son, 39 years old at the time, took his place at the mantle, at the helm of the leadership of the Chabad Lubavitch movement. And the authorities, they watched his every move. For 7 years, they tracked, they harassed, they threatened this new Rebbe. And then, on Purim Katan, today, in 1927, 7 years later, the KGB visited the Rebbe's celebration for Purim Katan, for this mini Purim. They did exactly what they had done. And it wasn't by chance. They knew exactly which holiday it was. They did exactly what they had done to his father 7 years before. And just like his father, learning from the best, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak displayed utter fearlessness. He spoke openly and without hesitation. He spoke about Mordechai, who inspired the Jews in the story of Purim to an unprecedented level of devotion to God, ready to give their lives for their faith. The Rebbe declared at that moment that every generation has a Mordechai, with the same objective, to inspire the Jews' self-sacrifice in preserving the Jewish spirit, keeping Judaism alive. 1 month later, on Purim, the Rebbe held a dramatic celebration. He dedicated nearly the entire night to addressing the crisis of the children's Jewish education and their need for self-sacrifice to make it happen. Talking about what was going on and how we were losing our youth, like all revolutions. The Bolsheviks, they wanted the youth. And even when they were able to look the other way when it came to adults pursuing religious observance, they were merciless when they came to educating the children. They wanted the kids for themselves, and they decreed that children must be enrolled and educated in their state-run atheist institutions. And the Rebbe that night, in 1927, declared war on them, to their faces. They were standing there at his celebration. The Rebbe demanded that people fight for their children's souls, and if they need be, give their lives too, which at that time, you know, something that's terrible about our society is we often think that people think just like us, that people act just like us. And so many of us cannot understand what it was like living under persecution during the Soviet time. People who I know who escaped that time, people in our community who lived through that, they've told me stories, shocking stories of what it was like living under communism, living under the Soviets and what they did to religious life and especially to Jewish life. At that night, while the Bolsheviks were there, 1927, he challenged the crowd to put their children in the clandestine underground schools so they would be taught how to be Jewish. It would be dangerous for them and for their children. But he said it's worth it. He declared the futility of making decrees contrary to God's ways of life. He compared the Soviets to Haman, the evil minister of Ahasuerus, who wanted to kill the Jews. And he promised that they would meet the same fate as this evil Haman who was killed. He mocked the Jewish communists for deluding themselves into thinking that they were immune from the brutal violence of the regime that they were serving. And around midnight, he did something that anyone present described as one of the most incredible moments of Jewish life under the Soviets. There was a man, when I was talking in Shul today, there was a person in our community, Arkady, who told me that his grandfather told him this story and that it put such a sense of life and Jewish life into him. He said, around midnight, the Rebbe leaped out of his seat. He opened his top buttons, which was not, it was unbecoming of a Rebbe, and he placed his hand on his chest. His face was aflame and he spoke to the crowd. He said, if you see my body on fire, do not panic. Fight on. We must fight for our children's souls. Fight. Don't surrender. Don't give them your children, no matter what. Do you hear me? Do not give them your children. Once again, the people there, they were in panic over the Rebbe's audacity. This was a very hard to go against, to fight against the Soviets. The Rebbe's own mother at this event approached him and asked him to watch out for himself, to stop antagonizing and provoking the Soviet spies sitting at the table. The Rebbe wept with her. He soothed her and then collapsed in a faint. 4 months later, to the day, also around midnight, the Soviets arrested the Rebbe. The plan was to take him to Spalerka. It was a dreaded maximum security prison. To have him shot that night, no one survived that prison. Miracles of miracles. They didn't. But they did torture the Rebbe. terribly. The Rebbe never walked again. For the rest of his life, he was in a wheelchair. They tried to break him. What was amazing is while they broke his body, they only angered him and evoked a superhuman strength in him. Eventually, thanks to God's grace, international pressure and the efforts of many people, mostly those of his actual future son-in-law and eventual successor, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, they ended up releasing and exiling the Rebbe to a distant village and then later expelling him from Russia. And that's how he got to the United States, where he lived the last years of his life in New York. 65 years later, on Purim Katan, today, in 1992, his son-in-law, Rabbi Schneerson, the Rebbe, it was his 42nd year of serving as the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And that night, in 1992, the Rebbe distributed a pamphlet to thousands of people. The pamphlet contained a Purim message that was written by the Rebbe, but it was based on the Purim message of those two celebrations of 1920 and 1927. The call for self-sacrifice echoed down through the decades. The Rebbe called now for a peacetime, is what the Rebbe called it, a peacetime type of sacrifice. Not a willingness to die for Judaism, but a willingness to live for Judaism. Every single year, I watch the event at Auschwitz. It's in May. It's mostly the young children, the teenagers who come with the March of the Living. They come to Auschwitz on the International Holocaust Day. And the event always begins with a message from the former chief rabbi, Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, the Holocaust survivor, the youngest survivor of Buchenwald. And he stands up and it gets me every time. It tears at my heartstrings. Every time I hear it, I probably have heard this message maybe 20 times already. He says, "My friends, Jews, we are so good at dying together. It is time that we start being good at living together. We're so good at dying together. It is time that we start being good at living together." The willingness to live for Judaism, that was the Rebbe's message. To be ready to renounce complacency, the contentment, and to maintain a wartime level of urgency, a relentless pursuit of improvement. Something happened since October 7th. There's an awakening, an incredible awakening. There's a couple different awakenings that I've seen, and this is my anecdata. I love that word, right? My anecdotal research, just from being a rabbi. And I'm sure other rabbis will probably have other similar anecdotes, but these are my anecdotes. I've seen definitely people come out of the woodwork, Jewishly. People wanting to do something more Jewish. People who I know who started putting on tefillin every day that had not put on tefillin before, but they started doing it for the hostages, for the soldiers. People, I'll tell you this one. For past 19 years that I've been a rabbi in Montreal, I would say I've probably written, now, in order to do aliyah, for a Jew to go back to Israel, you need to get a letter from a rabbi. It's one of the requirements from the aliyah office. I would say probably over the years, I've been asked by people in the community, maybe 10 times, talking over 19 years. Since October 7th, I've written over 40 letters. So that's one side, which is unbelievable. People really wanting to look into making aliyah, moving to Israel, realizing that Israel is the homeland of the Jews. Beautiful. Then there's others that are looking to, What can I do? What can I do? So obviously in the beginning, there was a lot of money being poured into Israel, so beautiful. And there's many very important institutions that still need that your money. And there's that. People have been doing mitzvahs, thousands and thousands of mitzvahs. And we don't do them because we don't do them for the release of the hostages. We do them because the hostages right now can't do mitzvahs. There's 134 people that still, over 5 months later, are being held, innocent civilians being held, the whole world screaming about Israel. But what about these innocent civilians? What about the hostages? And so we do mitzvahs for the hostages because they can't do them.
Are you tired of swiping right on every dating app out there and still getting nowhere?
Are you convinced that you'll forever be alone, surrounded by nothing but cats and empty takeout containers?
Hi, I'm Aliza Ben Shalom, the host of the new show, Jewish Matchmaking, which you can find on Netflix.
And I'm the Love Rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Bernath, and we're inviting you to join us for Matchmaker Matchmaker.
Each week, we'll answer one of your pressing relationship questions, from how to get over your ex to how to deal with your partner's annoying habits.
So if you're ready to laugh, cry, or maybe even find love, then tune in to Matchmaker Matchmaker, and it's available now wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And then I think there's one other element. I've heard so many young people on campus at Concordia, where I listen to a lot of young people there, or just where a lot of young people in the community at large, saying things like, maybe the Palestinians are right. Maybe we are colonizers. And this is why I think what Susie and Yehuda Shish asked me to do with their children, with Samuel and Diego, for their bar mitzvah, and I encourage every single person who is watching this right now to do this as well. Start from the beginning and go through Jewish history. I'm not telling you what to think. I'm not telling you what to answer. But you need to be educated. You need to know Jewish history, not revisionist history, that Jesus was Palestinian and Moses was Palestinian. I don't know where that came from. But the real Jewish history, start from the beginning, go through the Bible, go through the prophets, go through the writings, go through different elements and times within Jewish history, become knowledgeable. Somehow, there's this revisionist history going around, and young Jews are falling prey, thinking that maybe we're doing something wrong, that maybe Israel is not our homeland, that maybe we were not thrown out of Israel years ago, and the reason why, it's insane to think about. My great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, every single day, three times a day, he dreamt of going to that land ever since, for 2,000 years. We're not talking about people who forgot about a land. We were thrown out of that land. And then for 2,000 years, every single day, we prayed that one day we can go to that land. I can't imagine my great-great-grandfather believing that his great-great-grandchildren are able to just get on a plane and go to that land whenever they want. It's an amazing, amazing thing, especially after 2,000 years of praying and hoping every single day, facing Jerusalem. If you ask anyone, when you start prayer, where do you start? Got to find out where East is. Well, at least here. In North America, if you're in Australia, I think sometimes they do Northwest. I don't know, different places do different things. The truth is the earth is round, so, but we won't talk about that right now. But we do face East, and East is representative of facing Jerusalem. And we've done that for 2,000 years. There's an urgency right now. And part of that urgency is for us to be educated. We, the Jewish people, have always prided ourselves on education. We have prided ourselves on knowing, and not just groupthink, independent thinking. Somehow there's a lot of groupthink going around. People are not thinking for themselves. They're just taking. I mean, all of a sudden things start popping up on the internet and people just believe them at face value. My gosh, if I believed every single Abraham Lincoln quote on the internet, there's more quotes on the internet than days of his life in his name. It's our responsibility to know history and especially Jewish history inside out right now. And then we can make an educated decision for ourselves. I'm not telling you what to think or believe. Just educate yourself. That's always been the Jewish secret. Educate yourself. In 1992, Purim Katan, the Rebbe urged us to challenge ourselves, to keep growing, to keep pushing Judaism further and further along the historic path towards the coming of Mashiach. It was an amazing, amazing talk. Ba'ata Tetzaveh, if you haven't had an opportunity to study it, it's in English now. Just type Purim Katan 1992 Ata Tetzaveh. Maybe at some point I will do a class on it because it's such a powerful, powerful talk. The Rebbe really set down a mission for us. And I'll tell you something else. 13 days later, the Rebbe suffered a stroke that robbed him of his speech and his mobility. That was his last public speech. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, that was his last public speech. The last time he spoke publicly. That was it. He was unable to speak for 2 years, and in 1994 he passed away. Like the Rebbes before him, the Rebbe practiced and sacrificed. He left the world a living legacy of fearlessness, of defiance, of devotion, and a deep hunger for a world at peace with itself, at peace with God, devoid of evil, devoid of every kind of Haman, a world filled with holiness, with goodness, with kindness, a world where people can stop dying together, but rather living together. And what's amazing is, in 1920, and I never thought about it actually until I was thinking about it today, preparing for my sermon. 1920, the Rebbe Rashab passed away just a few weeks after that evening. In 1927, the Friedrich Rebbe didn't pass away, but it changed the whole trajectory of his life. And then in 1992, 13 days after this event, the Rebbe wasn't able to speak anymore. And it changed our relationship with hearing the Rebbe's voice. And I think that leadership is a very difficult thing. I don't wish leadership on anyone. It's a very difficult thing. And so often as leaders, people have to take a stance. And right now, the Rebbe said that leadership is left to the individual, to each and every one of us. And it's our responsibility now to take a stance, to educate ourselves, to know what to say. If someone says something and you're going, then it's your responsibility. It behooves you. I don't use that word so lightly. To do something about it. To say something about it. And I think that's what leadership is today. Is knowing and taking a stance. Don't let people get away with it. It's not fair. We've come too far. And Judaism is now in your hands. Can I say? I think we all know the task at hand. And I think thanks to Mordechai, the story of Purim, we're going to celebrate Purim 1 month from today. The generations of Rebbes who amplified his call to action, who filled his role, we're nearly there. It's now in our hands. We have that responsibility to heed the call, to educate ourselves, to speak up. Because silence, just as Elie Wiesel said, helps the perpetrator, not the victim. Silence is not good enough, and the world definitely is not speaking up on our behalf. So it's our responsibility. I wish all of you a beautiful week ahead, a week where we're able to see a week of peace, where our hostages are home, 134 of them, unscathed, where there's no more suffering, and a week that we could say, this is Adar, this is pure joy. Shavua Tov. Have a wonderful, wonderful week.
Hi, Rabbi Bernath here. I have some great news for you. My popular 4-week course, Kabbalah for Everyone, is available right now for free for the next 50 people who download it. All you have to do is go to www.theloverabbi.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and you're going to see the download button right there. In this course, I talk about the Kabbalistic secrets to relationships, to wealth, to happiness, and balance. This special offer has been dedicated in loving memory of Elie Dorfman. I look forward to hearing from you and hope you enjoy the course. Now on to today's episode.